Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. When was the last time you found yourself immersed in a book that you just couldn't put down? Do you recall the feeling of being transported outside of yourself? Good books fuel our imagination in a way television and other media cannot. What do we lose as individuals and a society when people stop reading? Robert Waxler is a professor of English at UMass Dartmouth and the co-founder of the Changing Lives Through Literature program, an alternate sentencing program. His latest book, co-authored with Martha Pennington, is Why Reading Books Still Matters, The Power of Literature in Digital Times. Welcome back. Good to
see you.
Thank
you, Mindy.
So you've long recognized the value in literature. It was back in the early 90s that you started the Changing Lives Through Literature program. So remind us how that program came to be and how it works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that program began in 1991. I started it with Judge Robert Kane and also a probation officer, Wayne St. Pierre. It started actually after a tennis match. I was playing tennis with Bob Kane, who is a good friend of mine. And we were talking about what he called turnstile justice. He was seeing the same person, the same people coming before his bench who had already been sentenced, and he was going to sentence them back to jail. And he was frustrated by that. I was always interested in trying to find various ways to promote literature, and I really did believe deeply that literature could make a difference in this case as it had in so many other cases. So I suggested to Bob at that time that we try an experiment. We'll take eight guys, I suggested, tough guys with significant criminal history if possible, and rather than sentencing them back to jail, we could take them up to the university and ask them to read some books around a table, some kind of seminar. And I also encouraged both the judge and the probation officer to come along to these class situations, and I would facilitate the discussion. So Bob got eight people. Collectively, they had 146 convictions before they came into the program, so they were genuinely tough guys. And we sat around the seminar table at UMass Dartmouth as an experiment. I made a list of books that I thought would resonate with some of their own emotions and feelings and difficulties. And we started to read. We read books like Sea Wolf by Jack London, Old Man and the Sea by Hemingway, Deliverance by James Dickey. And we spent about 2 hours each time after reading the books, talking about the books around the table. And it really became what I think of now as a democratic forum. People had interesting ideas. They came from all angles, a vision. They drew on their own experiences. They talked about the way their story mapped onto the story that we were reading. And we began to see dramatic changes as we went. Each person seemed to find their own voice, and they seemed to tap deeply into the literature, and they each had their own perspective and point of view on the literature. So by the end of the session, which was 12 weeks, we decided to continue that program. It seemed to be working well. The guys were talking about going back to school, some of them. They were excited about learning and about reading. And in addition to that, they seemed to be talking in new ways to their family and to other people that they hadn't spoken to for quite a while. So that was the very beginning of it. Since then, it spread. We have a number of programs currently going in Massachusetts, for example, about 17, 18 in various districts around the state. But it also spread to other states, Texas, Kansas, Rhode Island, California. There was even a program developed using the model of Changing Lives in England. And it seems to reduce the recidivism rate significantly. People who go into the program, often are, as I suggested, tough people, both men and women. But they seem to be transformed to a large extent as they read and as they discuss the literature and as they encounter, through language, their own selves at some deep level. I've seen this happen in my classroom as well. That's really where I got the idea, in a sense. I said, if it can work in the classroom, there's no reason why it can't work for anyone.
Yeah. So obviously, it's been very successful. But what do you hear from the participants once they've completed the program? You know, obviously, they're talking in different ways. But what do they tell you about what's happened to them through this process?
Yeah, so many things happen. That happens during the program sometimes and afterwards as well. Many of them go back to school. Many of them who have not been working very much begin to work much more. They often will tell me that they didn't think they could think like this. Mm-hmm. And suddenly they become much more self-reflective. They're thoughtful. They're surprised by what they're capable of doing. Many of them have not read an entire book until they read in the Changing Lives Through Literature program. And that in itself is a great accomplishment, because one, just to read a book, especially if it's a reasonably difficult book with real depth to it, is something that is not only worthwhile, but is a genuine accomplishment. You should feel proud that you've accomplished that. Many of them tell me that they are carrying the books both literally and metaphorically with them.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's a story that keeps coming up in my mind about the program, because it seems to reflect so well not only the quality of the program and what it means, but also what literature can do. I remember after one session we had read Old Man and the Sea by Ernest Hemingway, and there's a character in that story, Santiago, who's the old man, the main character. And we had talked about Santiago one night and talked about his heroic efforts, his ability to get up every morning, even though it was extraordinarily difficult for him, because for many, many days he had failed to catch any fish, and he would come home, he'd obviously feel down and out, but nevertheless, he would get up again. He did that for almost 3 months. So we talk about that kind of endurance and that capability. And he is, without doubt, a heroic figure. So I remember after that session, we were going to go on to another book the next time, and somebody came into the room before we began the next session to talk about another book, and he said, "Professor Waxler, there's something I'd like to say about something more about Santiago." So I said, "Yeah, sure, go ahead, tell us what you're thinking." And he said, "I was walking down the main street of New Bedford," which was Union Street in New Bedford, "during the week, and I was still thinking about Santiago. And I stopped at the corner of Union and 6th Street, and I was going to make a turn." And we all knew what he meant by that. He meant he was going to go back to his old neighborhood. He said, "You know, you might not know it, but I know a number of people in the room do know that I've really been having a tough time lately." And we knew that he really was talking about going back to take drugs again. So a large number of the people in the program do take drugs. And he said, "But I stopped at that moment before I made that turn. And I started thinking about the book, and I started thinking about the old man, Santiago. And I said to myself, as if I could hear the voice of Santiago at that moment, if Santiago can get up every morning and do this, if he can go back out for another day, at least for one more day, I can walk straight down Union Street rather than make that turn into the old neighborhood." He said, "Professor Waxler," I remember he started looking into my eye at that point. He said, "I can't promise you what's going to happen tomorrow or next week in terms of that," he said, "but at least on that one day, I heard the voice of Santiago."
Yeah, yeah.
And I when I heard that, I felt, this is what literature is all about. There's something incredible that has happened here. Here are just words on a page.
Mm-hmm.
That's all they are, really. We had talked about the book. We had sort of made that book alive, but this book had become alive for him, just as the character Santiago had sort of settled into his heart.
That's a
and Santiago
stuff,
was never, yeah. I don't think Santiago was, ever going to leave him as a friend.
Right.
So, so I said, that's what literature can do. And my view was it might have changed his life, and it might have saved his life, because, in fact, if he had made that turn that day and gone down into his neighborhood, he very well might have taken drugs, mm-hmm. and he might have overdosed, and he yeah. might have gotten into serious difficulty.
Yeah. Technology has helped spread literacy, but it's not necessarily introduced people to quality reading material. So technology kind of is a double-edged sword, isn't it?
I think it is. Without doubt. Technology and what I think of as screen culture, what a lot of people call screen culture. I mean, clearly, the culture that we live in now is dominated by screens and visibility and by images and by speed in that sense. And there's a kind of celebration of power. And it's not the first time we've seen this, obviously. Television and technology itself goes, you know, very far back into our history. But I think there's some really new components to this. And I think that the problem that is developing now is that almost everyone gravitates toward these small devices, the computer, the internet, the screens. And they're dominated by, to a large extent, by consumerism. Mm-hmm. They help to create a very, in my mind, flat, popular culture, which doesn't give us any, sense of our depth, of our sense of passion in terms of the heart and what a human being can really be. I also think that the screen culture, the internet, the computer generally, when we read it, allows us to surf through things very quickly and skim and not think very deeply about much of anything. As a result, we're not very self-reflective. Mm-hmm. I think knowledge is really given way to information at best. Yeah. I think, yeah.
Yeah, technology is encouraging people to demand more things and get them faster, both at work and with leisure pursuits. We think we can multitask and do all these things at once, but we know the brain doesn't work that way, so we can't really do that. But what do you think is we lose when everything's so fast and, we're not really stopping things? And I'm also thinking of, like visual images, whether it's right. TV or videos you see online or gaming, it's not the same as reading a book because they're creating the images for you, where when you read a book, you've got this part of your brain that's creating all of these images and what you envision in your mind for a particular character may not be what somebody else envisions. I mean, it's making you use your imagination, I guess is what I'm saying.
No, absolutely. I think that it's a great point and an important point. I think when you read a book, and it's a kind of reading which is very different than most other kinds of reading, you are, as you're suggesting, exercising your imagination. You are, in a sense, making a journey deep into your own self. You're drawing on your passion, your emotion. A reading of a good book, I would suggest, evokes both your conceptual ways of thinking as well as your feelings and emotions, your heart in that context. And also it has a somatic feel to it. That is, it actually can appeal to your and penetrate into your body so that you have a fullness of an experience. I think when you're looking at a screen, as you say, you're looking always at, often at least, at work that other people have already done. Mm-hmm. Screens are for watching. I think print is for reading, and that makes a big difference.
And we want to know, if you're a reader, do you prefer reading a traditional book or using an e-reader? And if you notice a difference in the experience of reading when you use an e-reader, we'd love to hear from you about that. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Robert Waxler about the importance of literature and reading. And if you're a reader, do you prefer reading a traditional book or do you use an e-reader? What's the difference for you in the experience when you're using an e-reader? 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. I have tried the e-reader. I feel like for me, there's a difference in focus. I feel like I can focus more, and something about holding the book in my hand versus, I don't know, and maybe it's, if you're reading in bed, you got the light of the, iPad or whatever. What do you think about e-readers?
Well, again, I think print culture asks you to do a different kind of reading than when you have a screen in front of you. And it's much more what's often thought of as an embodied experience when you're reading print culture. And part of that embodiment evokes everything that's inside of you. So you can learn something. It's personal knowledge that you can gain by reading a book. When you look, you're reading any kind of screen, whether it's an e-reader or just a computer for information, or you know, anything that looks like a screen in that context, and through the internet, it's not embodied. To a large extent, it's disembodied. And you've been trained to read differently when you start reading a screen, even if you don't realize that at a conscious level. So there's a kind of high visibility in a screen. There is what you were just suggesting. The feel of it is not mm-hmm. the same as it would be with a book. With a book, you can cuddle up with it. You can you can feel the pages of it. There's a kind of tactile.
I can dog ear when I want
you
to
can
go back
dog
to
ear
a page.
It. No, absolutely. And you can either you can move the pages back and forth with your fingers, which actually makes some difference. Yeah. There's also a problem with what's sometimes called multimodality with screens, where you've got whether it's an e-reader or a computer in general, you've got all these links, and you've got what we think of in the book as a kind of pop and bling kind of culture, where they're doing everything possible to distract you, really.
Mm-hmm.
They're moving you away from the attentiveness of deep reading.
I do like the laptop for like newspaper articles and shorter kinds of things like that. Although I do find when I am interested, I usually print it out. We're going to talk to Craig.
Okay.
Craig is giving us a call from Brewster. Good morning, Craig.
Good morning.
All right. Are you an e-reader or a book reader?
I do both quite frequently, and I have to say I was very skeptical when my 10-year-old gave me his e-reader because he wasn't using it. But in the last year, I really enjoy it. I think just functionally, I don't need a nightlight when I read. I don't keep my wife awake.
Yeah, that's true. I guess in that point.
That's true. Well, in terms of light, I suppose there's some validity to that. Again, the problem that I have with e-readers to a large extent is that you are trained in a different way to read a screen. So it's very hard, I think, to pay attention for a long time on a e-reader and be transported, as we were talking about it before, to really exercise your imagination the same way that you can when you fully embodied in the reading of a print book.
So, Craig, do you notice a difference in what Professor Waxler is saying?
I know. And, I have a hard time. I listen to a lot of books on tape when I'm working, and, I have a hard time remembering if I listened to the book, if I read the book, whether it was e-reader or paper. I find them all, somewhat equally magical.
Yeah.
I do want to point out my father is 93 years old and he uses an e-reader.
I think in that case that probably when you're 93 and depending on your health, picking up some of those heavy books might be a better option.
So that's true.
You can make those letters 3 inches tall.
That's right. Yes, and that's right.
He reads a book a week still.
Yeah. Craig, thanks for calling.
The point he has, they don't make an e-reader for elderly users, and the edge of the e-reader is too small, so their fingers hit the screen when they don't want it to.
Oh, right. Yeah, well, that's...
I'm just amazed no one's come out with an e-reader specifically aimed at, very much elderly readers to handle.
Yeah, well, maybe somebody will do that and make a fortune. Craig, thanks for calling.
I hope so.
Let's talk to Janet, who's giving us a call from Martha's Vineyard. Hi, Janet.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I am a reader, and I don't use the e-books. I just look at them, and it turns me off. And I'm not a person who does screen stuff. I don't have a computer in my house, and I don't have a cell phone. And I just decided a long time ago I didn't want to live like that.
Mm-hmm.
If on the occasion I need to use a computer to look up something, that I can't find in the book, I will go to the library in West Tisbury.
Right.
And that's how I operate. And I don't have cable, and if I want to watch movies, I get them from the library. Currently, I'm reading two books. One's called No Man Land, and it's about people, mostly elderly, who are impoverished, and they travel through the country doing part-time work. And the other book I'm reading at the same time is Sled Dog Trails, which I found at the Dumpty Library.
Great.
And I collect horse books. As you know, I have
a horse. I know you have a horse.
I found the most amazing books, even ones signed by the authors at the Dumpty.
Yeah. Well, Janet,
that's how I live.
Oh, thank you for sharing that. Yeah, and maybe it's more difficult for those of us who grew up without e-readers and screens. You know, maybe it's a habit thing that we're just used to holding. Like, same thing with the newspaper. You know, I do read newspapers online, but I find when I go back and look at them in my hand, I find things that I missed by not, you know, by being online. So I don't know.
Well, there is a there's a guy, Prensky is his name, who coined the term digital immigrants and digital natives.
Oh, is that right?
He said the digital, you know, the digital immigrants are probably people like you and me who grew up reading books and then they tried to shift over to reading screens. The digital natives are the ones who really don't know much of, you know, they didn't grow up writing reading books. They grew up reading screens, and it's much easier, in a sense, for them. They were obviously accommodating themselves to that kind of reading experience. But the issue, in part, even there, is, you know, what they're never going to know what it is to read a book. That's the real fear of
to
it.
To be able to tell the difference.
And so they'll never be able to tell the difference, you know, the contrast. I think part of the issue, as the last caller was suggesting, is also a sense that the screen itself automatically, I think, creates a certain kind of distance, right? I mean, as you were suggesting, you hold a book, but the print itself is right there in front of you, and it gives you a kind of a feeling of proximity, and and it helps to evoke this embodied experience, whereas the screen is already a device which is almost like a defense mechanism. So you can't get into the book
I will say, Craig did bring up a good point about the font size, because some of those things that have the teeny... it's tough. That's a tough read. Let's talk to George, who's giving us a call from Barnstable. Hi, George.
Hi. I guess a couple of observations. One, books are made out of paper, and they're made to last. They're made to be passed on. You can do all of that with an e-reader, but you know, libraries are centers of learning. My bookshelf at home is a whole set of memories that I can look at the edge of the book and think about what wonderful story that was. So I can't, and I guess it's the age, but I was, as your speaker has suggested, I was raised on reading books, and I think there's something sacred about having that book in my hand rather than that electronic thing. You know, let's hear it for real books.
All right, there's a vote for books.
That's
George,
nice.
Thanks for calling. And then Bob sent us an email, and he's voting for e-books. He says, e-books. Easy to adjust font size, easy to search book contents. Most e-readers have built-in dictionaries for reference. So Bob is voting for the e-books. All right, let me get back to your book, Bob. You write in the book that digital media is having an impact on education. So let's start by discussing the focus on STEM, science, technology, and math curriculum in our schools. There's been some pushback to change the acronym to STEAM, including the arts, and you agree with that. What's your argument for the importance of arts and humanities in schools?
Well, STEM itself doesn't include arts or literature. As you said, recently there's an attempt to create STEAM, which the A would be the arts. But even in that case, the arts, as it's being defined through STEAM, really does not refer to literature. It's or history or what we might think of as the humanities. And my argument is that we have a culture now And I think the internet is really contributing to this. It seems to be pushing further and further into sort of privileging the technology and science in terms of quantification and in terms of measurement and in terms of numbers. But one has to ask, what kind of life really is that? And is that, to what extent are we diminishing what the full capacity of a human being can really be like? My view is that it's extraordinarily important to educate the whole person. The human heart is included in that. It's not just numbers, and it's not just quantification. It's it's passion. It's devotion, its feelings, its emotions. A lot of our memories are embodied within the body itself, and we want to try to evoke those things as well. There's nothing in my mind that does a better job in terms of education, anyhow, than literature in that regard. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that has to do with language and with story and with narrative. I think it's only through narrative and story, something that's always been part of the life of a human being, that we really can get a sense of what the past was, where we are in the present moment, so we locate ourselves there and project ourselves a little bit into the future. And it's only through literature and more generally the humanities that we can fully understand the depth of our own selves. As a result, I think education, as it continues to focus on science and technology in particular, sort of narrows what we think of as being a human being. Mm. And what we lose, we know a lot about the surface of things in that regard, but we don't, in terms of our own personal knowledge, but we really don't know very much about our own depth of self. Again, I think it's literature and the humanities that really can offer us that. Mm-hmm. And right now, education seems to be much more interested in utilitarian ends, mm-hmm. rather than that question that Socrates asked, which was, which is to me the really important question. What kind of life do you want to live? Who are you? Mm-hmm. That's the real purpose of life, to make that journey.
866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. If you'd like to chime in, we'd like to know, are you an e-reader, a book reader, both? And since you got your smartphone or tablet, do you find yourself reading books less, more, the same amount? 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. What does the research tell us about the importance of reading for preschool and elementary age children?
Well, I think one of the important things is that there's evidence that suggests that for very young people, you should try to read to them as much as possible. And that means a caregiver, a mother or father, or somebody ought to be sort of sitting there with the young child, reading to them, pointing things out to them in the book. Hopefully you're holding a book when you're reading that. And talking with them. So it's the talk, it's the language, it's a sense of comfort, it's a sense of warmth.
Bonding.
It's the body. Mm-hmm. And all those things become part of the collective memory, so that by the time you're 5 or 6 years old, you're feeling pretty good about reading. There is also evidence in some studies, one called Baby Einstein, for example, that trying to teach things like vocabulary to very young children through a screen is absolutely useless. They did a study for trying to teach vocabulary, I think, for two-year-olds. And the group that did not use a screen actually did better learning the vocabulary, mm-hmm. and that kind of thing.
So we do see that digital media is taking the place of traditional reading for some children. Mm-hmm. But this was a concern back when TVs entered the living room, and we seem to have survived that. So what's different now? Is it just that there's more options than when we had the TVs first come into the living room?
Well, I think there are more options. I also think it's not we survived it. It doesn't mean that it was necessarily the best thing in the world, right? It's not clear that television helped people to read a lot better. You know, there were studies even on Sesame Street as an educational television show, and the suggestion was that what people thought might be being learned on Sesame Street really, to a large extent, wasn't being learned. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's good, it's entertaining, and there's a huge amount of entertainment on television, but there are some serious issues with television, including just the way television is set up, especially on commercial networks, where you have tremendous fragmentation. The story itself is so broken up that you don't really have that kind of consistent narrative. You have a lot of inattention as a result of that. People are not, you know, really focused on one thing for a long enough time to really be transported, as we were talking about it before, in terms of a book. When you're reading a book, it takes a while to really enter deeply into that book. Mm-hmm. You're transported because you get into the rhythm of the book, and the book meets your rhythm. Yeah. Television, first of all, does not meet your rhythm. It has its own rhythm. That's part of the problem with the whole machine culture. It's the same with the Internet. The Internet is speeding along. Google and Facebook and Amazon.com, and you know, they're the ones who have control of the network.
Right.
They're the ones that create the rhythm for us. They're the ones that, you know, send out that the colors and the noise and everything.
And target the advertising.
And target the advertising.
You know, and I was just thinking, in the TV, if you watch any kids show and you look at the advertisements that, you know, they're targeting at the kids. Mm-hmm. Same thing, like, you know, you look up something on, Google, and the next thing you're on Amazon and showing all, you know, these things that you just, targeting to what
absolutely
they think you want.
And they seem to know our desires much better than we know our own desires, right, which is even more problematic.
Yeah. What are some ways we can push for the return of arts and humanities to curriculums?
What is it?
What are some of the ways we can push to have arts and humanities return to curriculums?
Well, obviously, I think what we need to do is at least begin to have a serious conversation about what we really want from education. Right? Again, at present, it seems that we want science and we want math and we want technology, and we believe somehow that is going to make us into a better world. Mm. I think, you know, that it certainly is helpful, but it doesn't give us the inside of our own selves. If the question, and to me it is the fundamental question, if the question is, you know, what kind of society do we really want? Do we want a society made up of people who are really self-reflective, who are attempting to attain some kind of wisdom, who want to continue to exercise their imagination, who understand both the past, the present, and the future, find themselves located in a particular place at a particular time, want to pursue the question, the big question, you know, who am I? Mm-hmm. Want to make that kind of journey, think of life as a journey, then it seems to me for all those reasons, you want more humanities, you want more thoughtful reflection through language. If you want a society which is almost exclusively utilitarian in its focus, doesn't think so much about human beings as an end in themselves, but believes in you know, endless progress, believes in speed, believes in the ability to transform nature into something that is, other than nature itself, then obviously science and technology will win out. But I think at least we should have a debate about that, find out what people hope, really want out of life. As I said, the You know, James Baldwin was the one who said it, that I remember. He said, you know, we don't need numbers. What we need is passion, which is a great quote.
Yeah. We're talking with Robert Waxler, professor of English at UMass Dartmouth. He is the co-author of Why Reading Books Still Matters, The Power of Literature in Digital Times. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more for a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Robert Waxler, professor of English at UMass Dartmouth. He's the co-author with Martha Pennington of Why Reading Books Still Matters, The Power of Literature in Digital Times. 866-999-4626. We're asking you if you're an e-reader or a traditional book reader. Also, since you've got your tablets and whatnot, are you reading more or less, about the same? 866-999-4626, or you can shoot us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Irma is giving us a call from East Falmouth. Hi, Irma.
Hi, Mindy. How are you today?
Good.
So I read a lot, and I read a lot on my Kindle only because it's easier for me to hold, but I still like the power of the written book. But I'm more interested in what my grandsons are reading, and they seem to be reading a lot of graphic novels. I'm wondering what his opinion is of it.
That is a really good question, because graphic novels are hot among the younger
generation.
They are.
There's no doubt about it, along with Harry Potter and Hunger Games. My view is that language itself is really central to this whole argument. And it's language that really makes us, as human beings, human. We stand out because of language. We have a culture, to a large extent because of these screens, which is so, it's a culture that embraces images, visibility, to such an extent that almost everything becomes an image. So I don't feel as comfortable with graphic novels as other people do, because I think it's really part of a popular culture, and it doesn't allow you to fully be transported through language itself. As we were talking at the beginning, when you're dealing with language and just language, you're reading a book, for example, it's not necessarily easy, because you have to exercise your imagination. You have to think about the characters. You have to, in a way, become the characters, operate in the scenes that have been given you through really just black dots on a page or black marks on a page. So you have to do all the work of creating that story, which is not easy, but it's extraordinarily powerful, and it's extraordinarily rewarding. Now, you begin to bring images into this. The images are already there. I mean, you can help create the images, but the images already take something away from the imagination, I think.
Yeah, Irma, thanks for the question. And the other thing I'm thinking about as you're talking is through reading and as you're mentioning stories, that they give us windows into other people who may not be like us. So educate us, you know, diversity. People who may be going through a particular rough time and they read a book, they're like, this is exactly what's happening in my life. I'm not the only one, you know, who, you know, you're reading about anxiety, let's say, and this is me. So there's a lot of power in that as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And again, you know, there's something called theory of mind, which we talk about a little bit in the book, where you learn to read other people, both. You get a better understanding of what other people are thinking about, the cognitive skills that you can sort of infer that are in terms of not only your mind but the mind of the person with you, but also the emotional skills or the emotional feelings that other people are having. And you can train yourself almost through a process of reading and getting to know these characters from books, so that you can read actual people in a much better way, right? I mean, reading is reading.
Some empathy as well, yeah. All right, Darren is giving us a call from Provincetown. Good morning, Darren. Darren, are you there? All right, I think maybe we lost Darren. Let's go to Harriet, who's giving us a call from South Dartmouth. Hi, Harriet.
Hi, good morning. What a great topic today. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
I personally prefer books myself, and my husband and I are co-founders of a nonprofit called Hands Across the Sea, and we actually help to create school libraries in 6 Eastern Caribbean countries. So we've shipped about 374,000 books down to about 390 schools serving 78,000 kids. And I can say without a doubt that at least the kids in the Caribbean really, really love books. And they're highly valued and prized, even in this era where a lot of people in the Caribbean have smartphones and they can, you know, read stuff on their smartphones. They still love and value and prize books. And one thing I just want to say about graphic novels, for children, especially boys, they can be like a gateway drug into the world of books. Mm-hmm. So you can start boys out with some graphic novels or some graphic, you know, easy readers, and then they get hooked on reading, and then next they may be reading books with fewer pictures and words.
I like that, gateway.
Yeah.
Graphic novels is a gateway to
reading. Well, yeah, and the whole idea of, you know, as long as we have so many different habits anyway, the book habit is a very good one,
To have, yeah.
It's
Harriet,
nice to have a habit of reading.
Yeah, and Harriet, thanks for the work you do.
That sounds terrific.
It sure does.
That really does sound terrific.
All right, let's talk to Jackie, who's calling from Orleans. Hi, Jackie.
Yes?
Hi, go ahead, Jackie.
Hello?
Hi, go ahead. Yep, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to say that I enjoy your program so much.
Thank
I've called in before, and this morning, that story that your guest told about the prison, I thought was so inspiring, the seminars he's having at the prison.
Yep.
And books do so much. I choose my book sometimes from what NPR tells me about it. They have the authors on it. The one I'm reading now is by an author who was on NPR, and that's why I chose it. And it's a Hillbilly Elegy. It's a very good book. But I always enjoy your guests. Thank you so much.
Thank you for calling, Jackie.
Thank
appreciate
you.
That. Dan says, do your students prefer e-readers over books, and do you find that changes over the years in technology and how your students absorb information?
Yeah, one of the interesting things about the students in terms of e-books and the print book is that they prefer the e-book in the sense that it's easier, as people have mentioned, to get a hold of. It's also often less expensive. They can carry it around with them. It's often, they're not lugging a big textbook. They can put it in their small bags, things like that. But they almost always say that if there's anything important, they would prefer to have the print book. The print book is usually more expensive, and that's one reason why they say they use the e-book.
Mm-hmm.
But if you ask them if everything was equal, which would they prefer, they almost always say the print book. The other interesting thing about that is that I've noticed that people who read either on a screen generally or an ebook in particular, who want to really think about something, will Xerox the part of the book that they are really interested in so they can read it and reread it and hold it and see it in print. And somehow that seems to allow them to embed the information in their consciousness in a way that they can't quite do it with a screen, or at least that appears to be the case.
Yeah. Eleanor says, as an undergraduate English major at an Ivy League university, I was asked to tutor some of our business school students who could not graduate without passing their required English literature course. Until then, I had never met people who didn't read literature or even see the point in reading. It was a semester of learning for me as much as for them. One fellow proudly told me he had read a book. Title and author gone from memory, but he had read a book. These guys later went on to become titans of industry, but I always remember with astonishment their lack of curiosity in the qualitative pleasures of literature. Thanks for a much-needed show.
That's exactly right, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think curiosity has a lot to do with it. And there are different kinds of curiosity. I think the screen, as one person has suggested, we meant to talk about this a little bit in the book, allows for what might be thought of as a diversity of curiosity. If you're curious about a lot of things and you just want to get a little knowledge about them or a little information, you can sort of scan through the, you know, search the engines and, mm-hmm. and get a little information. But there's another kind of curiosity. It's called epistemic curiosity. Epistemology, it really is. And that's a kind of curiosity where you really want to get into the depth of the thing. You're curious because you want to get a deep understanding of how it relates to you. And that takes, a long time. And you've got to work at it, and you've got to be attentive to it. And I think that, again, a book or print culture generally lends itself to that kind of curiosity in a way that the screen just doesn't. The screen purposely tries to distract you after a while, right? I remember there's a guy, Carr, who said, you know, what the whole purpose of the screen is to catch your attention so it can disperse it as quickly as it can.
So what makes a work of fiction literature? What are some of the key components?
Well, literature, I think, it, first of all, has a heightened sense of language itself. It uses more imagery. It has what many people call literary. It's literary language. It's not information. Secondly, literature, especially if we're talking about fiction and narrative, has a story to it. And that story mixes what might be thought of as the familiar, things that we are familiar with to a certain extent, verisimilitude, together with artifice, the sense of something new, something unfamiliar. And so when you read a really great work of fiction, you are reading something that has kind of heightened language to it. You're not reading for information. It has a kind of multidimensional quality to it because you are thinking about the depth of the experience as you go through it. It has characters that you might know, you might not know, but they have something, those characters have something in them that you can identify with. And that's both the familiar and the unfamiliar. They're interesting because there's something unfamiliar and mysterious about them, but they're familiar enough so that you can make some kind of connection with them.
Right? Yeah. We have just about a minute left, but I'm thinking as we're talking about, you know, the power here and the emotion that we have when we have a good book, can poetry and music provide similar experiences for a reader or listener? I mean,
well, poetry certainly can, and a lot of poetry has music. I think the music and the rhythm is very important. That's even true with fiction. The musicality of the language becomes an important part of what great literature is all about. I have some questions about music in relation to poetry, though, because poetry also has language. So language has that kind of cognitive ability that music doesn't always have. I mean, I listen to music, and I often can't tell, unless I already have a context, on what exactly the music is all about. I just have a feeling for it. Whereas with language, there's a cognitive as well a dimension to it, as well as a feeling dimension to it, and it has that appeal to the body. Yeah. Music may not have that as much cognitive quality to it.
We will have a link with more information about Robert Wexler and Martha Pennington's book, Why Reading Books Still Matters, The Power of Literature in Digital Times, at our website, capeandislands.org. Always good to see you. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you, Mindy. Thank you so much.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.